This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Hello and welcome to It's All Greek
and Latin
to me. I'm Jimmy Melville, a TV producer who fell in love with classics as a boy at a comprehensive school in Liverpool.
Salve, Jimmy. Salvete, omnes. Hello, everyone. I am Armand Angour, professor of classics at Oxford University.
Ah, now, if my memory serves me correct, that's hello in Latin, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I haven't forgotten everything. Welcome again, everybody, to It's All Greek and Latin to Me, where each episode, Armand and I are going to unpick a phrase or a piece of writing, a story, a thought that was written over 2,000 years ago by the ancient Greeks or by the Romans. And we're going to unpack it for you, shine a light on it, and show you just how relevant it is to you and me living in this very day. Now, since this is the first episode, we'll talk a bit more later on about who we are and what we're planning to do with this podcast. But in the spirit of the quote you were brought for us first, Armand, we aren't going to waste a second. We're not going to drop the ball at all. We're just going to jump straight in. And the expression is?
Carpe diem. Yes, yeah. Seize the day. I mean, you mentioned carpe diem to anyone. They say, oh, yeah, seize the day. Well, that's the standard translation of it. I think what I'd like to do is suggest that it's not necessarily the best translation for it.
But controversial already, Armand.
Yeah. Well, where does it come from? So it comes from an ode by Horace writing in the 1st century BC, a time of great tumult and change, the change from the period of the late Roman Republic through to the early Principate. That is when Augustus becomes emperor after Julius Caesar is killed. Augustus takes up his mantle and becomes the first Caesar emperor. And Horace is writing, well, amongst other things, a series of odes, which are short poems. And in one of his early odes, in book one of his, there are four books in book one, ode number 11, he writes a short 8-line poem addressed to a woman. And that woman in the ode is called Leuconoe. It's a Greek name. We don't know who she is. And I would translate her name as Bianca, because in Greek, Leuconoe means white mind. Bianca, of course, means white. Something to do with whiteness and innocence comes across. So he says to her, "Don't ask, Bianca, for we may not know what end the gods decree for me or you. Don't try to learn the future from the stars. It's better to accept whatever comes, whether we're bound for many winters more, or whether this one, buffeting the rocks that front the Tuscan shore, will be our last. Be sensible and strain the wine instead, and trim down long-term fancies. While we talk, ungenerous time runs by. Enjoy today, and place no trust in what tomorrow holds." Enjoy today. Carpe diem is
that's
what he says.
That's a very nice translation. Who translated that?
That's me.
That's you. That's good.
Yes, no, that's a nice translating translation. A lot of Latin poetry in a way that is, I hope, totally accessible, but also uses rhythm and rhyme.
And you've translated carpe as enjoy.
Yeah, enjoy today.
Yeah.
So literally, carpo in Latin, carpere, means to pluck.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people might say it's about harvesting the best bits of the hour of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And you might say, not as American, as seize the day.
Is it a horticultural expression?
Very much so, yeah. So and in fact, there's also a pun, probably, because the Greek word karpos means fruit.
Yeah.
So it's almost like fruit the day. Enjoy the fruit of the day.
Suck the fruit out of the...
Find the fruit in the day. Yeah. And, you know, a little bit early, he says, trim down long-term fancies. I mean, the word for trimming down in Latin, reseces, it's about pruning, it's about pruning back, pollarding, whatever. Don't let things straggle, trim them down, enjoy the moment. So don't let your perspective stretch into the far future. Harvest what you've got in front of you and not what's coming, you know, because you don't know what's coming.
Because seize is much more aggressive, isn't it?
Much more aggressive, yeah.
It's a bit kind of macho, isn't it?
It is macho.
Seize the day.
It's not really what Horace is saying.
Because pluck is actually quite delicate, isn't it?
Indeed.
Because this poem is a kind of intimate moment, isn't it? It's an intimate conversation between two, certainly people who know each other, whether she exists or not. He's imagined that he's having a conversation with a woman, maybe over a glass of wine.
Yeah, and looking out onto the sea.
Yeah.
Looking out onto the Tuscan shore, perhaps this is Western Italy, Naples, where they have pumice, which is mentioned, these rocks. Let me just briefly mention the metrical scheme. Carpe diem, da-da-da-da. That's the rhythm of this whole poem. Da-da-da-da, long, short, short, long. And when he talks about this could be our last winter, in Latin the word for winter, hiems, also means a storm. So the statement hinges on that ambiguity, because he says, is this going to be our last winter? It's buffeting the rocks that front the Tuscans. Well, what he means is, of course, it's the storm that's buffeting the rocks, not the winter. Mm. But the same in Latin, the same word, hiems, winter or storm. And then he says, which now buffets the rocks that front the Tuscan shore. In Latin, each of the words in that line have that rhythm. So he says, oppositis debilitat pumicibus, dum-diddy-dum, dum-diddy-dum, dum-diddy-dum.
You get the rhythm of
carpe diem, carpe diem, carpe diem. So he's pushing forward this rhythm, which is a Greek verse rhythm. What Horace has done in his odes, he's taken a lot of these rhythms from Greek, and uniquely he's turned them into Latin. He was very proud of the fact that he was the first great lyric poet, and in some ways the last, that Rome produced. And so he's writing all this in Latin in these wonderfully complex meters. You know, so he's painting a little picture here. It's a story of the two of them looking out and thinking, let's enjoy now. The storm's out there. We're inside. We've got our wine. We've got our friendship. Let's have a good time.
So when I first read this and I realised he was talking to a woman, It does remind me when I was in my 20s and, you know, you're talking to a young woman you quite like and you're saying, you know, time's short. We should really be getting on with this and just let's have fun and let's party. And isn't he trying to sort of maybe get her into bed or maybe?
This is one of the interpretations of this poem that is actually quite common and, of course, was picked up by Andrew Marvell, who wrote his poem to his coy mistress. If we had world enough and time, this coyness would be no crime. Mm. I mean, you know, his mistress is being coy, but he said, we don't have time to procrastinate, to hang around, so let's just get down to it.
Yeah.
That clearly is one reading of this. I have to say it was something that perhaps I was rather naive about, because I read this poem in my teens and I thought, oh, he's talking about this much more philosophical aspect of seizing the day or at least enjoying the moment. Looking back over it, I realised that I probably did miss a trick or two, not least because it is addressed to a young woman, obviously, someone who is interested in the future for me and for you. That's what he says. Don't ask, because we are not allowed to know what end the gods decree for us. Mm. In other words, are we going to be together, maybe she's saying. Mm-hmm. You know, are we destined for each other?
Yeah.
He says, don't try to learn the future from the stars. In Latin, it's do not consult Babylonian numbers. So this is Babylonian astrology. Yeah. Quite common, a little bit frowned on, I should say, at the time. Under Augustus, astrologers were actually expelled from Rome. Maybe he's saying, look, we shouldn't put any trust in that kind of Oriental futurology. Whatever the case, however, I think it does end up as being an invitation to have a bit of fun now.
Do you think she's trying to get him into a conversation about where's our relationship going, Horace?
Well, I think that's a
possibility. And he's doing a massive deflection like blokes do, going, look, let's not talk about that right now, because you're having fun, aren't we? Why do you want to pluck on that thread? Don't carpe that. Carpe the DM.
Horace does genuinely, I think, believe in this notion that you have to be someone who recognises that life is short and that you can enjoy moments. And, of course, that is also an expression of Epicurean philosophy,
yep,
to which he is devoted. He calls himself an Epicurean. So there are two main philosophies inherited from the Greek world. Both were created in the 3rd century BC, so a couple of hundred years before Horace's writing. Epicureanism and Stoicism.
People confuse Epicureanism with hedonism or hedonism, don't they? They kind of get them mixed up. I mean, I remember, you know, people saying, oh, it's that biblical, like, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. I didn't realize it came from the Bible. Is that kind of hedonism? It's not hedonism, is it, at all?
Well, we call it hedonism. That means...
But that's seeking pleasure, isn't it?
Excessive pleasure.
Yeah.
But actually, the word hedonism... For Epicurus, because he said pleasure was the highest aim, that is the aim that we should have in life. That is what Epicurus says. But what he meant by it was not what we mean.
Mm.
He didn't mean excessive sensuality. In fact, quite specifically, he ruled that out, because he says the problem with excessive pleasure-seeking or sensuality is that it's going to lead to pain. You know, you get drunk, you're going to feel sick. Mm. You overindulge in anything, there'll be a backlash. So what he said was that the sort of pleasure you should aim at is what you might call is a kind of a static pleasure, a contentment, a tranquility that allows you to be happy. And that is the key to your life.
Mm.
And so that is what Horace is picking up here, as it were, that simple pleasures, just straining the wine, as he says, enjoying a drink with a friend. This is the kind of thing that Epicurus suggested was deeply important: friendship, simple pleasures, nothing excessive.
And how old would he have been? Do we know when, how old he was?
Yeah, so he was born in 65.
When he wrote this poem?
BC. We don't know how old he was. These were published in 23, in his early 40s, so he would have been writing in his 30s. Mm. So a lot of his odes present a personality rather than a reality, you might say, an autobiographical reality. We don't know very much about Horace's autobiographical situation. He tells us a little bit in his satires about, you know, he was sort of short and chubby. But, yeah, he's someone who wants to present himself as a poet in different ways. And he's a bit of a raunchy bachelor. He talks about his former love affairs. He's quite rude about some of his former lovers. We don't know how, as I say, biographically true all that is, because a lot of what he's doing is drawing on the genre of lyric poetry that exists in ancient Greece, which has a lot of these themes, erotic themes, invective, that's insulting. Mm. And he's picking up on those, and he's making it about himself.
Mm.
But is this him, or is it what's called a persona, a mask, that he's presenting to us through his poems?
Mm.
You know, this implication of this poem is that he's a slightly older man, say in his 30s, with perhaps a younger woman.
Mm.
We don't know the circumstances, but he's more mature. Mm. He has a philosophical view about life, and he can say to her, don't worry about how we're going to end up.
Of course, he's an outrider for the, it was a very kind of, the huge industry that it is nowadays, of the mental well-being industry, isn't it? Because keeping it in the day, there are organisations that talk about, you know, you've got to keep things in the day. I know that a lot of self-help groups, for example, talk about people with neuroses and people with mental health issues. It's about, don't worry about tomorrow. I remember once I was in California, I was doing a TV show, and my family came out. It was the summertime, and my daughter was a bit older. My stepdaughter, Paige, was a bit older than her brothers, so she was too old to go to these camps they have in America, these fantastic kind of day camps. So she worked in the garden of a Vedanta temple. Now, Vedantism, I didn't know, was espoused by Aldous Huxley, who is a part of Hinduism, and it's a very inclusive religion. And the temple in Montecito near Santa Barbara is very beautiful, and every religion is represented in their temple. So you have a crucifix, you have Buddha, and lots of flowers. And my daughter worked in the garden, and she came home in the evenings. God, the nuns, the Vedantist nuns are great. They're just like, you know, they don't wear uniforms and they swear, and, you know, they're people, they're real people. And they invited us for lunch, and we go up and we have lunch. And the lady who ran it was called the Vrajaprana, and she was a New York woman, Jewish by religion, original, and had espoused this very inclusive, very forgiving religion. And I sat in the shop with her where she was selling spiritual books and homemade granola. She called it holy granola. And I said, look, I'm thinking of trying to meditate, which is about, you know, carpe diem, is trying to slow my brain down. I said, my brain sometimes goes off in all kinds of directions.
Mm.
And I later, a couple of years ago, was diagnosed ADHD. And the old joke is, how do you know someone's got ADHD? They'll tell you. So I've just told you. And she said, well, I advise people not to beat themselves up, because most people say, oh, I can't meditate. I can't clear my mind of all thoughts. You're not meant to, she said. Just spend 1 minute a day, I think. 1 minute to start off with. And meditate upon the very second of your death. I start to imagine, my eyes wide open, I imagine I'm very old. I'm 98 years of age. I'm surrounded by my family. I'm looking at a clock on the wall, massive clock, like an Alfred Hitchcock clock. And I see the second hand going around, boom, boom, boom. I'm here. And I start saying, I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. I'm here. I'm not here. I'm not here. I'm not here. And I calmed down. And I thought, wow.
Fantastic, it worked for you.
That's interesting about, of course, the mind is saying to you, Jimmy, one day it's all over.
Yeah.
What are you worried about? And I think this is, you know, that's what this poem speaks. So I think it's a jokey poem, a sexy poem, and it has depth, real depth in it when you start plucking on carpe diem.
That's right. And be in the moment, as you rightly say, is a very common Eastern notion, Zen or Buddhism or any of the Eastern philosophies, talk about being in the moment. It's very, very hard for us to do it.
Yeah, I find it impossible.
And the Romans were not that keen on it, interestingly. They didn't feel that Epicureanism was the answer because traditional Roman values were much more aligned with Stoicism. Mm. So the idea of being a Stoic, having some sort of, you know, inner strength and believing in doing the right thing by your society. So Epicureanism is quite antisocial. It's telling you to go under the radar, but the Stoics espouse political activity. And so, interestingly, they would have found it a little bit disreputable for Horace to be recommending just enjoy the day and forget about tomorrow. I mean, it's very important for the Stoic, for example, and for the Roman to be wise, to understand fate and to see how things roll out, to accept it indeed. And interestingly, in this poem, there is that Stoic advice as well. So Horace is being a little bit, you know, he'll have it both ways because he says, it's better to accept whatever comes, right? He's telling her, ut melius quicquid erit pati, just accept whatever comes. That's actually Stoic advice. I think he knows he's playing both sides of the instrument here. He's telling them, well, accept whatever comes, but at the same time, enjoy the day. You can do both.
But acceptance is a, you know, there's a whole journey to acceptance. Acceptance is when you are at peace, isn't it, with a situation. And you go through all the different stages of negotiating with the reality of it and anger and fear and shame. And then you arrive at that moment of acceptance. I'm always a bit suspicious of people who've had something happen to them which is against their wishes and they say, no, it's fine. And you know it's not fine. You know they're going to have to go on an internal journey to make it fine. And to accept whatever comes is very difficult, isn't it?
Yes.
Fine, I think, is one of those kind of blanket English expressions where we say, I'm fine, don't inquire any further. You know, but trying to accept what comes. But I want to ask you about procrastination because I am bedeviled by it, you see.
Well, ask me, but, you know, hold on.
Tomorrow. I know that Oscar Wilde thing. Why should I put off till tomorrow, like do the day after? But it is the thing. I talked to my son about it. My older son and I are great procrastinators. And he described it. He said, well, the thing is that I think of the task at hand and then I attach a bit of anxiety to it. I don't like the anxiety, so I push the anxiety out and it drags the task with it. So I don't get to do the task. And do you procrastinate about anything?
I think we all procrastinate. What I do know is that when I get on with the task in hand, I'm much happier.
Yeah.
It's something that I think is also an occupational hazard of modern life, that for all sorts of reasons, we want to put things off to the last minute.
Yeah, I think it's crippling. I think for some people, it is really, it damages them. And I think that line from Shakespeare, that was Richard II, says, I have wasted time, now time wastes me. And that feeling of, I say to my children, you know, that I just think the older I get, the idea of wasting time, because time is the only thing we all have each day. Going back to the day, actually, when I was 50, I had a tumour in my throat and they took it out and they radiated me and I went for my checkups and I was driving this wonderful doctor mad by asking about my possibility of survival. And I go back every month and say, so what are my statistics now? And he got so fed up with me, he said, Jimmy, after about 18 months, Jimmy, he said, listen, he said, you wake up in the morning, you go to bed at night. Like everybody, you have either 100% chance or zero chance of making it through the day. Just live in the day, he said to me. And actually, it's a great way of just stopping worrying about what's coming down the road is you look at your feet and think, well, I'm here now talking to you. You know, what can go wrong? It's fine. But it's difficult because our minds are fizzing with other things, of things we need to do.
There's a particular academic disease of perfectionism. If I'm not going to get it absolutely right, then I don't want it to go out into the world. So you put it off until such time you think you've got it absolutely. I mean, it's a bit like this podcast, right? You know, we've just got to get on with it.
Yeah.
We're not going to say...
Oh, by the way, this is not perfect.
we can't even aim for perfection.
As the audience is now nodding away, you're absolutely right, guys. This is not perfect.
No, you've just got to get on with it and see what emerges. But if you left it to the moment you thought, I've got all the answers. I know exactly what to say. I know exactly how I'm going to talk about Carpe Diem. Then you never do it because you can't get to that stage. So you've somehow got to suck it and see.
Now, Armand, I guess because this is the first episode, we maybe talk about, for the benefit of the audience, so that they don't think we're a couple of lunatics, how we actually got into classics in the first place. Because I was thinking, sitting here, the last time I was doing a one-to-one with a professor of classics, I was 22 years of age, I think. And I had a little feeling of kind of PTSD there as I sat down. I thought, God, I'm with a professor. When you rang me and said you wanted to do a podcast about classics, I kind of thought, well, who's going to listen to it? Because, you know, that's that awful stereotype that classics is a dead language, it's a luxury item. Now, you know, I did classics at school, as you know, and I'm now a television producer, so I don't do classics anymore. Here you are, you're a world expert, a professor in classics. Why did you ring me up and say, let's do a podcast about classics?
Lots of different reasons, but one of them is that you are involved in Classics for All, which brings classics and teaching of Latin in particular into state schools and has managed to get to something like 70,000 pupils over the last 10 years, which I think is a fantastic thing. And it has an awful lot to offer. But specifically, if one looks at actual texts and phrases that are common in everyday life and ask oneself, where do they come from? What do they mean for us? What's their significance? Now, classics is a whole world. It's the whole world of the Romans and the Greeks. It's something that produced some of the greatest literature, some of the greatest philosophy, drama, and so on.
You see, what's odd to me is that as a television producer, I can see on TV, there's always a drama or a series set in the ancient world. We have a continuing fascination.
Yeah, and don't people think about ancient Rome three times a day? I see men think about ancient Rome three or four times a day or something.
It's the latest meme. Or sex. I can't work out which. No.
The same difference.
Yeah. But I know when I studied it as a kid, I mean, I was, you know, people don't believe this, that I went in Liverpool in the 60s and 70s, I went to a comprehensive, and my mum was a waitress, my dad worked in a factory, they both left school at 14. They were very bright people, just didn't have the educational offer that I had. And there in this school, there were people teaching Latin and ancient Greek and ancient history, the full English breakfast of classics. You know, when you say now that, you know, classics was available to the working classes, people find it strange because they think, well, when was that? Because nowadays, classics is the private domain of private education.
So why is it, do you think, that your school was teaching classics?
Well, I think it was recently, it's 1966, and it was when the world turned comprehensive. So actually, they didn't have time to slim it down and strip it of some of these other subjects. It was a grammar school, and it was converted into a comprehensive. It was teaching Latin and Greek and Russian and German. And a wide range of subjects which just are no longer available. But by the end of the 80s, by the mid 80s, there was no classics to be seen in state education, certainly in Liverpool. But I have to say, not having studied it for the rest of my life, I've carried it with me for the rest of my life.
Right.
And it resonates deep within me. I mean, I agree with you. I think it's really relevant. I'm really grateful that, you know, that I recognize things, especially history. I see something happening in the present day. And I once said to Mary Beard, you know, you should be on the end of every cabinet table. And when these idiots who are running the country have an idea, you should say, well, excuse me, this happened actually in 43 BC. This, and then give the information of what happened in the past. Because it strikes me that people don't know history as well as they should when they're making these decisions. Because, you know, we just keep repeating the same mistakes. But anyway, how did you get into this? When you were a kid? And clearly you're a musician. I mean, I've seen you play. I mean, you're a professional. It could have made a professional career out of it. So why did you fall into classics?
So I've always had a parallel interest in both music and classics. So I studied Greek at a prep school. I had a wonderful teacher, John Evans, who just inspired me. I was, seven? And, I mean, I remember, in fact, that he walked into the schoolroom on the first day. And he was a wonderful draftsman. He could draw things brilliantly. And he drew on the blackboard a picture of a girl's face with flowing hair. And he said, "Haec puella est." This is a girl. And I thought, you know, I had a seven-year-old thinking, I know exactly what that means. I was so fascinated by the fact he was speaking a foreign language, which I knew was Latin, and I knew what it was. And I just thought, I've got this. So I went on, learned Latin from the age of seven, and the following year, he realized I was this complete nerdy, you know, enthusiast. And he created a little booklet for me with wonderful pictures. And I'm desperate because I've lost it, because I'm sure I've got it somewhere. But I remember, you know, for example, he had three little fat little Greek men with bags on their backs, each bigger than the other, in order to demonstrate the comparison, the superlative, you know, big, bigger, biggest. And, you know, that sort of thing just touched my imagination. I went on and, you know, I got a scholarship. So I didn't come from a very well-off family. I got a scholarship to Eton. And in those days, if you were good at the humanities side of things, you were directed towards classics. Mm. A fantastic raft of old-fashioned, brilliant classics teachers at school at the time. And so when I left school, I took a few years off and went to music college. I then went back to Oxford and read classics there for 4 years. So it was a lot of studying. I then came out and I decided I wanted to be a musician. And eventually I found my way back to the classics, which is where I am now. But it's a long and convoluted story, but music and classics have been in parallel all my life.
It's interesting you mentioned the teacher when you were a little boy, because this charity I'm involved with, Classics for All, we're now trying to get into primary schools. And I've sat in a lesson in Liverpool, in Anfield, near the football ground, with this fantastic teacher. And of course, with this charity, they just take a biology teacher or history teacher and they give them 2 days training and they take these kids through the course. It's peer group learning. And these kids were lighting up because the first lesson was etymology.
Oh, yes.
It was just, do you recognise this word? She put up Maximus up on the screen. What kind of English words do you think we get from Maximus? Mm. Little kid next to me put his hand up and goes, Miss, yes, Sammy's, Pepsi Max. And of course, she's a great teacher. She went, absolutely right, big Pepsi. And it's a very moving story, I think, because I think everybody I've met who has been inspired to go on and do a subject normally encounters a teacher like that, that kind of lights the pilot light.
Yeah.
And I had that experience with my teacher, Mr. Cashin, is that he kind of understood. I was quite a disruptive child in many ways, but kind of all over the place, really. And he kind of harnessed me and he suggested Latin. And I was quite good at Latin. And he said, look, ancient Greek is right up your street. You should do ancient Greek. And I said, well, I'm not sure in ancient Greek. He said, you'll have to give up geography and chemistry. I said, you had me at geography. I hate both subjects. I'm in with ancient Greek. And I just loved it. I loved the idea of being in my bedroom in working class Liverpool. And both my parents were now dead. You know, they were lovely people, but they had problems with alcohol and they worked hard. But it was quite a tumultuous home. And being in my room and knowing that Mr. Cashin had my back and I was doing work for him, I disappear into this world of classics, of, you know, Roman literature or Greek history. And I'd find these people in these stories and they'd give me clues on how to live, on what it kind of made. It made my life more manageable by doing that subject. And it was him. He lit the pilot light, Mr. Cashin. He's the, you know, that Dead Poet Society thing, that moment. And as a quote from the film called The Holdovers.
Oh, yes.
And I thought, that's why we're doing the podcast, because it's such a... Have you seen the film?
I know, I'm about to.
You've got to watch this film. Yes. And Paul Giamatti is a teacher, and he teaches classics and history. And he's in a museum, and the kids are looking bored. And the character says to his pupil, he says, there's nothing new in human experience, Mr. Tully. Each generation thinks it invented debauchery or suffering or rebellion, but man's every impulse and appetite, from the disgusting to the sublime, is on display right here all around you. So before you dismiss something as boring or irrelevant, remember, if you truly want to understand the present or yourself, you must begin in the past. You must see history not simply as a study of the past. It is an explanation of the present. Fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, this is what the point of our podcast, in a way, is that...
It has a contemporary resonance.
The connections are so... So we spent, you know, we've been talking about how Carpe Diem obviously resonates with us. I mean, we're alive in 2024 and it resonates with us. But actually, I don't know whether you knew that it's kind of been taken up by Drake, the rapper, who's turned it into his own way of expressing this idea of enjoy today. And it's YOLO. Do you know what YOLO is?
You only live once.
You only live once, yeah. And that's so, you know, if it's good enough for Drake, it's got to be good enough for us. I think that's all we've got time for. So it's Salve from him.
And it's Valet from him.
What's Latin for two Ronnies?
So So, if you enjoyed this episode, do subscribe and follow for more. Next episode, we'll be talking about Oedipus.
Hooray!
And the Oedipus complex, a phrase that's often casually dropped into conversation. But do you know what the actual story was and what it really means? Find out next time, when we'll be unpacking more great literature from the classics.
Can't wait.
It's All Greek and Latin to Me is presented by Armand Dangour and Jimmy Melville. The producer is Diggory Waite, and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. It's All Greek and Latin to Me is a Hattrick podcast.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give a mention to Classics for All. Classics for All is a charity, and what we want to do is provide access to the classics to as many state school pupils as possible. Alongside training teachers who don't actually have to have any previous training in the subject, they hope that they make classics a sustainable part of the school curriculum. If you want to find out more about this fantastic charity, go to the website. It's www.classicsforall.org.uk.